Our gospel reading this morning is Luke's account of the resurrection. On the first day of the week, very early in the morning, the women took the spices they had prepared and went to the tomb. They found the stone rolled away from the tomb, but when they entered, they did not find the body of the Lord Jesus. While they were wondering about this, suddenly two men in clothes that gleamed like lightning stood beside them. In their fright, the women bowed down with their faces to the ground, but the men said to them, "Why do you look for the living among the dead? He is not here. He has risen. Remember how he told you while he was still with you in Galilee, 'The Son of Man must be delivered over into the hands of sinners, be crucified, and on the third day be raised again.' Then they remembered his words. When they came back from the tomb, they told all these things to the 11 and to all the others. It was Mary Magdalene, Joanna, Mary the mother of James, and the others with them who told this to the apostles. But they didn't believe the women because their words seemed to them like nonsense. Peter, however, got up and ran to the tomb. Bending over, he saw the strips of linen lying by themselves, and he went away, wondering to himself what had happened." This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. I have four brothers. Yesterday we had a friendly golf outing. I'm just going to cut to the chase. It came down to the 18th hole. I had a putt on the 18th green. All I needed to do was two putt it, but it was a slippery downhill putt. I was too aggressive. Went 15 feet past the hole. I missed the comeback putt. My side lost. The text I got from a brother on the winning side this morning said, "Your putt yesterday was too long. Make sure your sermon this morning isn't." So you have an ally in one of my brothers. So if I go too long, it's nothing about you. It's just a vindictive interfamily thing. On Easter Sunday, we hear the report from the Gospels that God raised up the crucified Jesus. We face here not an intellectual puzzle or a conceptual tangle. The tension this creates for us is not really about whether we can get our minds around this news that is unlikely, unprecedented, and to be honest, difficult to believe. The only interesting question is whether this story of resurrection can pull us across a threshold and into a new kind of life. The problem for most of us, I think, is not so much the lack of hope or the absence of hope as it is the fickleness and flimsiness of the way we usually hope. If this story today can become the occasion for God to do something new, to change our hearts and our lives, the change in us will involve the shift or a pivot into a more durable and a more satisfying, joyful hope. Some of you already know that I turned 48 this past week. And that Geico commercial where people slowly turn into their parents, a little too close to home, a little painful for me this week. My most recent passions in life, which happen to be for houseplants and for birdwatching, these passions do not convey the vibrant youthfulness that I had hoped to be projecting at this point in life. Elaine Berge kindly gave me a split-leaf philodendron, and I care for that thing like it's one of my own children. I'm so enamored of all the beautiful little birds in my backyard that I have downloaded a birding app, which I'm very excited about. My family makes fun of me, but this app is amazing. It's called Merlin. It's created by the ornithology department at Cornell, and it's just amazing. I highly recommend it. I can take a picture of any bird, and it'll tell me what the bird is. Based on my location, the app can tell me what birds are migrating in and through my specific area right now, so what I should be watching out for. I don't want to brag, but there's this adorable little red house finch building a nest on my front porch right now. Technology is amazing. That might not be your favorite app, but you have your favorite app. The comforts made possible by advanced economies like ours is amazing and alluring. And I think it's helpful for us to name this sort of optimism that drives our lives in a society and economy of progress, so that we can ask ourselves whether this optimism might be not quite what we want, whether it's too small, too flimsy, too fickle to serve as the kind of hope that can guide us and sustain us in deeply satisfying lives from beginning to end. The story that the crucified Jesus has been raised, this prompts us to ask some large questions. What might we hope for ourselves? And beyond that, what might we hope for others, for the world out beyond ourselves, if we can ever get there? Luke's gospel invites us to see ourselves in this group of women that go to the tomb early on Sunday morning. The women named here by Luke are the same women he mentions earlier in the story at chapter 8, verses 1 through 3. And these women are those who provided for Jesus during his Galilean ministry up north, where he was from in the early days of his ministry. They provided for him, says Luke, out of their own resources. When Jesus invited the crowds to become his students, when he invited the crowds to take up a new way of life, these Jewish women signed up. So what was it about Jesus that inspired them and fueled their hope? What made them join this movement, even at significant costs of their own resources and time? Apparently, Jesus' practices of healing the sick, extending forgiveness and mercy, and sharing meals with the poor, apparently all this way of life captured something deep in the longing of these women. When they met Jesus, something flickered to life in them. He helped them dream of a new possibility for their own lives and for the world around them. But on this Sunday, early in the morning, the women, as we meet them, they are grieving. They'd been crushed by events. They had come to prepare the dead body of Jesus for burial. They woke up that morning in a bind that might sound familiar to many of us. They nurtured deep in their lives this longing for new possibilities, and yet that longing had been shattered by the old realities of how the world works, its hatred and its violence. We too live in this tension of frustrated longing, so let me just take a minute and mention some of the things that can happen to our practices of hope in this tension. Sometimes what we hope for is simply unrealistic, given the kinds of creatures we are. Hoping that we never get sick, or hoping that we never have to experience death, those are always subtle temptations for us. This secret dream that's at work beneath the surface of our lives is there more often than we want to admit. Likewise, hoping never to feel pain, never to have an accident or a mishap, never to experience health challenges, never to encounter failure or disappointment, hoping never to be wrong, hoping never to have to change your mind. These are familiar forms that hope sometimes takes, and yet these profoundly unrealistic forms of hope are often what lead to much of our frustration in life. Sometimes what we hope for is bent or misdirected. We're prone to being wrong often about what actually will bring us joy and satisfaction. Take, for example, the problem of wealth and possessions and stuff. Now, in general, most people know that having a high income, the perfect house, nice cars and clothes, exotic travel, expensive toys and gadgets, most people know that all of that won't make you happy. But in our culture, status is largely doled out in bluntly economic terms. And so people pursue lucrative careers and nice things, not because they really believe these things are the pathway to real happiness, but because our culture offers very few other ways to keep score. It's not always clear to us how to measure life, that is, what makes life meaningful and satisfying. And so, because we fragile creatures get easily confused and distracted, we throw up our hands and play by the rules of the game as they're offered to us. Sometimes what we hope for is just too small. We might dream of personal projects and never get around to dreaming and working for the flourishing of our local place, the community where we live. We might be so busy acquiring a comfortable life for ourselves that we have little energy left for the needs of our place and for our neighbors with whom we share that place. We might become so enamored with personal comfort that we lose sight of God's love for the well-being of the whole earth and all the creatures in it. Sometimes our hope is bedeviled by our impatience. This is the first spring for my wife and I and our kids in a new house. I want a lush yard. I want the grass to be thick and green. I want colorful flower beds and a fruitful, productive garden. But my yard is all crabgrass and henbit. The flower beds are a disaster, and the garden was, until very recently, nothing but a plot of weeds. We're trying to improve this. Working on these areas will take not just months, but years. And it's hard to be patient and to do one small thing at a time. Those of you who have engaged in yard projects and home projects know what I'm talking about. Hope is a form of desire. It's a longing without the possession, without the having. And it's difficult to live in that tension of desire that doesn't yet have what it wants. So here, hope has to deepen into the realization that if a new future is going to emerge for us, for our communities, for our neighbors, and for the world, it's going to have to emerge in bits and pieces as God uses ordinary people like you and me to model what's possible. Finally, sometimes we find ourselves almost unable to hope. We get tired, we get discouraged and disappointed, we yield to despair and cynicism. We become overwhelmed by the difficulty of our journey through life and the pain that often accompanies all our efforts to just move forward. Notice that in Luke's story, two illumined men, strange description, two illumined men charge the women with remembering the words and actions of Jesus during his ministry. The resurrection story is not some brand new thing unconnected from the story that comes before it. The fresh opening for new life and new hope will be found precisely by allowing our lives to be shaped by Jesus' practices of mercy, forgiveness, healing, and table fellowship. The way of life that Jesus models is, in fact, the key to a durable and sustainable hope. And the hope that emerges from this new way of life is not animated by a silly dream of fixing everyone and fixing everything around us. Instead, we're invited into a resolute, determined life that moves forward into a new age, a new realm only just now beginning to take shape. We learn from Jesus the art of imagining a reality that's only half here. And captured by this new vision of what's possible, we become early adopters, taking up a new way of life that's ahead of its time. A way of life that's at odds with the old, stale assumptions of common sense. When this story seems to us like nonsense, and it might, we can only pray that God will pull us into the wonder and into the amazement of hope.